This is the Porno Cultures Podcast, the show where we think about pornography rather than just react to it. Welcome to the Porno Cultures Podcast. Within pornography studies, we get so wrapped up in hardcore representation that we oftentimes forget about the vast amounts of softcore texts that are just as worthy of our academic attention. Just before the quote-unquote golden age of theatrically released pornography began in the late 1960s, there was a very important period where the Hollywood studio system was crumbling as a result of new laws requiring that they let go of their profitable movie theaters, and the popularity of the new medium of television was keeping people inside their homes for the hippest new form of entertainment. As a result of the studios losing their primacy as America's preferred entertainment option, the studio heads started to loosen their grip on the kinds of films they would release, and they allowed young new producers to make the type of films that would connect with the younger audience who were still utilizing cinema as a way to escape the confines of parental supervision. As a result, from the late 1950s through the early 1970s, we were not only witness to what has been called the era of New American Cinema, that saw movies from Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, Five Easy Pieces, Easy Rider, and the Godfather movies made, movies that were a sophisticated high-end American response to the French New Wave films coming out of Paris in the 1960s, but this was also a time where not-so-artistic, quickly produced, and cheaply made movies were rushed into theaters to capitalize on a teenage market that was hungry for action, violence, and of course, sex. This era of exploitation cinema not only produced stories about juvenile delinquents and black exploitation movies, but also sexploitation. Exploitation movies. These exploitation movies took the conventions of the 1950s teen beach movie and added sex to it. They also took the conventions of the 1940s noir movies and added nudity to them. And they even borrowed from sci-fi conventions and, of course, unsurprisingly, made them sexual. In short, sexploitation is more than just a film genre. It's a new mode of production in the early 1960s that served as an important bridge from the dominance of the studio era to the eventual business conglomerate takeover of cinema in the 1980s. Exploitation cinema is also an important preamble to the theatrical era of pornography in the 1970s and showed pornographic filmmakers just how versatile sex can be within a variety of cinematic genres. In many ways, the need to establish pornography studies as a serious academic discipline has mostly sidelined the issue of exploitation films. Eric Schaeffer's Bold, Daring, Shocking, True, A History of Sexploitation Films from 1919 to 1959 serves as a definitive exploration of the history of sexploitation cinema. However, there hasn't really been much theoretical examination around these films or their social, economic, and critical context. That is until the release of Elena Gorfinkel's wonderful new book, Lewd Looks, American Sexploitation Cinema in the 1960s. This book is a deep theoretical dive into the legal history, feminist perspective, legal conditions, and critical response to sexploitation films. It's a range of films that has not been given the critical attention they deserve, and for those who don't know much about them, this book is a good place to begin your dive into the world of sexploitation. In this interview, we talked to Elena about how Kim's Video in New York City facilitated her interest in sexploitation films. We talk about the Marxist and feminist implications of sexploitation. We consider why film critics in the 1960s were so bored watching sexploitation. And we talk about her role as the co-chair of the Adult Film History Special Interest Research Group, which is a part of the Society for Cinema and Media Studies. Since Elena is working in London these days, there's a slight difference between our audio, but considering that we had this conversation 3,000 miles apart from each other, I think that it came out pretty well. So without further ado, here is my interview with Elena Gorfinkel.
Do
I'm here with Professor Elena Gorfinkel. She is a senior lecturer in film studies at King's College London. She received her dissertation in cinema studies at NYU in 2008. Elena's intellectual interests are varied, to say the least. She is just as comfortable writing about smut as she is about high art. She's written about the movie Meek's Cut Off and Slow Cinema and Bodies in Art Cinema. She's also the co-editor, along with Tammy Williams, of the new anthology Global Cinema Networks from Rutledge University Press. But the aspect of her career that we'll be talking about today are the dirty parts, specifically her first book, Lewd Looks, American Sexploitation Cinema in the 1960s, published by the University of Minnesota Press. Wow, congratulations. It's a flood tide of books coming out all at once.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off the podcast by asking our guests about their first experience with pornography. How old were you and what were the circumstances under which you got to see it for the first time?
That's an interesting question. I think perhaps the first encounter with pornography was fragmentary and possibly diffuse, and perhaps involved softcore more than hardcore, so that also may connect to the subject of my book. But I think I was encountering lots of different things, romance novels, which I would just read the hot parts of romance novels at the library. I also would watch like Cinemax late at night, realizing that things were kind of on that were dirtier than what was available. So oftentimes I think my relationship to sex on screen or sex in other forms of media was about indirection, misdirection, and diffusion in some ways. I think perhaps maybe the first time I ever saw hardcore porn was in what someone has recently written an article about woods porn. I was at a camp or a summer dacha with my family in upstate New York, and these girls and I saw these pages ripped out of a porn magazine. Those were all fragments of my memory about pornography. I think hardcore, probably in my teenage years, I found tapes somewhere and watched them. So those are a kind of variety of impressions, impressionistic impressions of my first encounters with images of sex. But oftentimes I was very aware of what I couldn't see as much as what I could see. And maybe that also connects with the subject of the book and my interest in the indirect image or the implicit image or kind of things that are not necessarily explicit sex but suggest things off screen.
Yeah, this article about the woods porn, it speaks to a lot of people's experiences. A lot of people have this experience with the woods. It makes you wonder, where are kids in the future going to have their encounters now that there's no internet hard drives to be found in the woods?
Right.
And since your first book is about softcore sexploitation, and you mentioned that was one of your first experiences, can you remember some of the first sexploitation films that you saw, and what was it that interested you so much about them?
I didn't come into graduate school thinking I would be writing about sex or sex films, but I think the first sexploitation films, in quotes, that I saw were actually once I had already started graduate school, but also what was really striking to me was the way that they just seemed to come out of nowhere to me, and I had no idea that they existed. But the first encounter I really had with sexploitation was actually through the work of Doris Wishman, who came to my feminist film theory classroom because she was a guest at the Underground Film Festival. So the first truly cinematic experience I had was with her films, and particularly Double Agent 73, which was an unwitting exercise in screen theory. And I was really quite taken with this premise of this film, in which here is this woman making a film about a woman who's a spy, has incredibly large breasts, and there's a camera implanted in her breasts, and there's a spy narrative, and the camera itself is supposed to explode at a particular point, so there's also a timeline. So I thought it was this really brilliant, if in some ways unknowing, way of engaging with all of these premises of the apparatus of screen theory. So my interest in sexploitation started there, with actually one of the few women making films in sexploitation. And it opened up from there, because I realized there was this whole body of work I was just really surprised by and in awe, in a way, of the volume of films, but also the way that I just wanted to understand how the films were seen, how they were understood, how they circulated in the public sphere.
It's really amazing how film academics use all of their power to, you know, utilize psychoanalytic theory to, you know, situate the camera as an extension of the penis. And then just on a whim, a sexploitation filmmaker completely flips all of that around by putting the camera in the breasts of the woman, creating a female gaze in a way. It really is an amazing film for anyone who hasn't seen it. I saw it for the first time last summer in a New York theater, and it still provides a lot of excitement for the audience as they're watching it. It's an amazing movie. you spoke about feminist theory. Intellectually, what do you think is drawing you to research and write about such opposite side of the cinematic spectrum? I mean, talking with you, you know so much about high art, yet you're also engaged in such low art. Do you see them having more connections than we might initially imagine?
I guess my interest in theory was through feminist film theory, and it was also, I guess I'm a product of a particular moment in the 90s when certain kinds of debates, there was a kind of Foucault era of theory and thinking about institutions and practices. But I was very much a theory person when I entered graduate school, and I was very interested in crass forms of popular culture, so that the kind of high art thing that you flag is something maybe that developed later. But I began to see them alongside each other, or see that they had a lot of affinities and areas of convergence and intersection. And these films in particular also stage certain problems in that respect too. But I think that my interest in feminist questions were really grounded in questions of the body. What does it mean to author sexual subjectivity, and also the contradictions of that? And I felt like feminism and feminist film theory provided all those tools. I think that I became a film historian by choosing this object, but I didn't in advance think that I would have to go into the trenches of film history in this way that I did.
Yeah, you're really showing off all of your skills in this book because you deal with theory and history a lot. You know, it strikes me that they're both marginal objects. One is a marginal object that everyone pretends they don't see, yet they do see. And one is a marginal object that everyone pretends that they understand and see, yet they don't. So it's interesting how their marginality plays out in different social ways.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. And I think certainly I was always interested in that question of marginality, and these films in some ways were the holy grail of that. And I guess I also like to take seriously a culture that seemed to be an incredibly masculinist culture, and to really think through what the films were arguing about sexuality for me was really quite important. To take these works seriously, even if they seemed really crass and vulgar and shoddily made, or, you know, made on a very short time frame, and seemed to be indulging in the worst, most preposterous ideological presumptions about what women should be like or act like in the public sphere. And so that for me, having a kind of serious engagement with the film, so like beginning with the text, but also thinking about their context, was really facilitated by my theoretical training. But historical training was through the struggle of piecing together what I could and understand about their context.
In Lewd Looks, you credit Linda Williams and Eric Schaefer for providing you with the theoretical framework that you're going to be working with throughout. But in so many ways, you're doing something pretty different from what they do. And the texts that you're working with are trying to do something different for their audiences, the difference between hardcore and softcore. So in what ways did you feel like you needed to adjust your approach to analyzing softcore from the ways in which porn study scholars have been analyzing hardcore texts for decades? You posed a question yourself when you asked how to historicize and theorize the implicit rather than the explicit image.
Yeah, I thought that the work of Schaefer and Williams was really incredibly important for me. And in some ways, their work really bookends the project with Schaefer's magisterial volume about the classical exploitation cinema from 1919 to 1915 at the front end and on the back end. Williams's account of Hardcore, her incredibly important work for it that generated the field of porn studies. But I think in some ways, perhaps I was combining their approaches, or in some ways taking aspects of both of their approaches. Schaefer's deeply historicist engagement and very archival engagement, thinking about mode of production, and Williams, who was really interested in textuality, discursivity, and kind of what the image does and the psychosemiotic implications of what the hardcore image is. So I think that I came to the films having deeply studied both of their approaches, but then also wanting to understand something unique to these films and their contexts. And I think there is a way that my interest in spectatorship, drawn from the trajectory that I took through feminist film theory, really organized my interest, partly because I was quite fascinated with the historical spectator of the films, but I was also really fascinated with the way that the spectator manifested itself in the films themselves and the anxieties around watching semi-explicit or as hot of sex as you could see in public space in the 60s, in a public space of the theater. That, to me, me was dramatized in the films. And so I feel like I was drawing both from thinking about the work that the body does in the film image, and then also thinking about the work of the body of the spectator in the space of exhibition and the circulation of the idea of the spectator. And that is in some ways the fusion or both of those works. But in terms of softcore, and I think that the films are the beginning of what we understand as softcore. They're films that are made with an interest in sexual content, but that sexual content is not about hardcore intercourse, obviously. If people haven't seen these films, it's important to describe them. They often feature scenes of ecstatic corporeal activity, but they're often figures for a sex that remains off screen. There's nudity in the films, usually female nudity, breasts and buttocks. And by the late 60s, we see a simulation of sex. So for me, the conceptual problem of the films was like, okay, what do we make of these films that are both offering the promise of some kind of sexual explicitness, but also then withholding it? And that tension with the audience and that engagement with the audience, that teasing the audience. Tom Waugh talks about the tease as the address of the sexual culture of the 60s. And so for me, that question of the tease, both prohibition and plenitude, are what's at stake in thinking about the films.
Yeah, it strikes me you go maybe even a step further than Waugh and even Miriam Hansen, who kind of theorize about the audience, but you have so many interesting examples of how the viewer of the sex is situated within the actual text. So you have more of a textual analysis of an audience and viewing than typical studies. And it's interesting that these films situate that, because they're thinking of themselves and their own place within a cinematic universe as well, in a way, which makes the book so compelling. You pick up your time period from 1959 to 1972, and for people that aren't so familiar and to contextualize, you articulate definitions of different types of films, nudie cuties and roughies. Could you kind of give like a little definition of each term and the type of characteristics that each genre of sexploitation embodies?
There's a common parlance around the films that generated a lot in the recirculation of the films on video and the Something Weird video era, in which the films were redistributed. But it's common to bracket the films into a series of cycles. And I try to show that the cycles are useful to think through, but they're also in some ways perhaps limiting as a way of categorizing the films in terms of subgenres historically. The sexploitation, I should say, is not a genre of film. It's a mode of production. There's a certain kind of content that's in them, but they vary quite widely generically. But within the period, we see a series of cycles. The nudie cuties develop right after nudity becomes, and they're the first of the sexploitation films, and they're marked by a very important film by Russ Meyer, his first film, The Immoral Mr. Tease. And they're comic in tone. They have aspects of burlesque and vaudeville. They're often episodic, and they feature a voyeur figure who's sometimes bumbling, middle-aged or older schlub who happens to be able to see women in the nude or is able to spy women in the nude through various devices or gimmicks. In some cases, films have see-through paint or x-ray goggles or have other premises that facilitate these comic scenarios. In some ways, these are kind of playboys brought to life, and they draw a lot on pinup culture as well as the burlesque films of the 50s and the nudist camp films of the 50s, and kind of fuse them into these somewhat lighthearted films. Then Meyer's the first to make a nudie cutie, and then there's a series of copycats. And so until about 63 or 64, we see quite a lot of nudie cuties on the market. And there's a sense in which producers feel that there's a fatigue and that they've run their course, and other kinds of films begin to be made. And that leads to the cycles of what are called later on as roughies and kinkies, and the expansion of modes of representation by the late 60s. But roughies are shift to a kind of black and white filming, whereas the nudie cuties are made in color, and they become much darker. In some ways, they show less nudity oftentimes, and they feature narratives that are a lot about violence and have grim endings in which there's some kind of comeuppance for some kind of sexual pathology that's explored, and they feature kidnapping and rape, and so they're much darker films. And kinkies are a variant of roughies in that they're more concerned with sadomasochism, and there's a way that the films also, they're quite porous. They're like sponges in a way. They draw from the popular culture of the time and the discourses of sexual science, so that producers are drawing from a lot of different sources for the premises of the films, and kinkies take up some of the things that one would see, for example, in like fetish magazines, or where they would take up a narrative of a dominatrix, or they would feature SM or kink-oriented premises, or consider women embroiled in activity that features action that has some aspect of SM. The Olga films are in some ways associated with the roughies and the kinkies. And so there's this proliferation of sexual subjects. We also have films that are sexual exposés. So there's a way that the cycles have a limit because they're also nudie westerns. And so there's a way that the cycles are useful, but they're limited frameworks for understanding. They're useful for categorizing the varieties of different films because there were hundreds of films made in the 60s that were sexploitation films. And so accounting for that volume, it's useful to have generic frameworks to put the films into.
And speaking of the films, you started writing the book in the early 2000s, and this was still kind of a transitional period from VHS to DVD. Was it especially hard to find some of these texts that you were writing about? What kind of hoops did you have to jump through in order to find some of these texts?
Well, it wasn't hard to find the films because this was, as I mentioned, Something Weird Video. It was like the most significant and important distributor of these films. Something Weird Video, run by Mike Franning, who passed away recently, and his wife, Lisa Petrucci. They collected and rediscovered these films. They bought prints from whomever they could, and they have this business, and they developed an audience for these films. So when I started, I was watching these films on VHS, and I would go to the video store. I was in graduate school at NYU doing my PhD, and in the back, just before the porn section in Kim's Video on St. Mark's Place, there was a section that was almost entirely, the wall was full of Something Weird titles. So I would go to Kim's Video, and I would, in many cases, bootleg the film on extra long play on so that I could have like multiple films on a single tape. And that was the beginning of my research into those films. So my access to them was, on the one hand, through the film festival context, was through film, watching films on film, but more than that, it was really through VHS. And so that seeing the ways in which the films have transitioned and changed in terms of their distribution and circulation has really been quite interesting, or the kind of restorative preservationist approach to the films that companies like Vinegar Syndrome are now lovingly restoring these films, I think, is really quite interesting. But I think there are also ways that certain films fall out of distribution through those transitions as well, or if certain films, because of licensing, disappear, you can't access them anymore, you have to find other means. So the question of the archive with these films is bound up in the fact that the films don't exist in a public archive, in a university archive. They exist by virtue of having been collected and recovered, and for their being sold as video for kind of a rental or a purchase market. And so it's a very different experience of research than more canonical cinema.
And some would say that navigating the clerks at Kim's Video is its own challenge, harder than any archive with the elitist crew that they would have there. Rest in peace, Kim's. We miss you. You write that, quote, "The film spectator is central to sexploitation's generic industrial and social identity." Can you expand a bit on more on what you mean by that? And what is the most essential thing that you learned about the audience at this time while writing this book? What exactly were they looking for?
I think the anxiety about looking is really baked into the identity and the formal and social structure of the films. And because these films are the most sexy thing one could see in public in a theater in the 60s, short of watching an experimental film like Fuses or Flaming Creatures, there was ways that these films were pushing the envelope of what kind of sex you could see in the theater. And so the tensions and anxieties around looking, as well as the development of a male consumer that has the capacity to purchase and experience, are all central to sexploitation film. And so if we think about Playboy and Esquire and magazine cultures that are developing in the 50s and the consumer identity that's bestowed to the male consumer, there is this interesting way that sexploitation films dramatize all those tensions around the problem of looking in the films. In many cases, I think there is a real way that consuming sex is something that the films frequently return turn to. And so there's often this question about selling sex, looking at sex, the conditions of looking, as well as the way in which the viewer is addressed in a way that's much more self-conscious and reflexive. And I think to me that really centers the spectator. So I was interested in both the textual, the way that the films have an address to a spectator that's textual. For example, Peeping Toms, a film called Strange Compulsion, which features a man who's kind of visiting his shrink and talking about how he's a voyeur and he can't stop. And the boundary between looking and doing is constantly being raised. And so there are films like that. And there are also films in which looking leads to sexual pathology, for example, in like the Finley films. And also the Nudie Cutie films clearly foreground the act of looking. And that shift from a kind of male access to a female access, where women become consumers by the late 60s, there's a kind of a liberalizing of a position that the exploitation films take. But in terms of the audience, I mean, I found out a lot of interesting things about the audience, because in some ways I was like interested in the audience, and I was really curious about like, what did spectators think when they saw these films? These films are so strange, and also probably were shocking for that feeling of the currency of seeing something for the first time or having access to something in this public space for the first time. To me, I wanted to recover that, but I discovered a lot of things, and among them, there are ways of diffusing or negotiating the anxiety or the disreputable nature of going to a sex movie house, or being narrated by film critics, as well as being investigated as a problem by sociologists and others studying the problem of obscenity in the late 60s. And so I was surprised to find out the ways that the couple's audience was quite important for sexploitation films by the late 60s, and how certain films were instrumental in developing that audience, particularly the films of Radley Metzger, both as a distributor and a maker of films. I was also surprised by how much material I ended up finding in which people were actually talking about seeing sex films and being curious or bemused or bored by sex films. And so I found more than I thought I would, and so that became a thread throughout the book.
We'll get a little bit into that later. The degree of boredom is kind of surprising that you found on record as far as people's reactions to these films. This also comes up against a lot of political resistance, especially when it comes to trying to censor these films. In our interview with Whitney Strub, we talked about Charles Keating and his organization, the Citizens for Decent Literature. So it was nice seeing him mentioned in your book as well. They were a group founded in the Midwest whose aim was to pressure local businesses to stop selling pornographic materials. I was really struck by how you frame one of the organization's arguments in the book when you write that in appearing in court, Keating claimed that the film Carmen Baby's, quote, representation of the mediated fictionalized act of sex was itself tantamount to the public act itself, unquote, and that the court eventually capitulated to this line of argumentation. The reason why this is so striking is because this line of argumentation strikes me because it is essentially the same argument that anti-porn feminists today use in their case that porn is inherently degrading to women and actual evidence of their assault right on camera. They seemingly do not understand the difference between actual sex and pornographic performance, or even worse, they purposefully capitalize on the naivete of people not familiar with the filmmaking process to intentionally cause panic. So I was wondering, what do you make of these perverse alliances between the right wing and the what is supposed to be the progressive wing of feminism?
Yeah, I think it's really quite interesting. I mean, Whit Strub's work is excellent and really quite incredible in articulating that trajectory, or the ways in which the left lost the battle to the neoconservatives on the terrain of these questions of sexual expressivity. But I think it is interesting. Keating is a really fascinating case of somebody who is very much an opportunist, building a case and also promoting himself and his project at the same time, but really making this case about the sex film as itself an act, sowing that anxiety and eliminating the boundary between something that's performance, something that's labor, something that is representation, and making it a case of it being kind of an offense to the public psyche. By virtue of its existence, it's an action, and it's an action against that public psyche that contaminates it. I think it's impressive in the way that it makes this case and moves against the tendency of free speech cases of the time. You know, he was moving against it. Keating is quite interesting too, because he would embroil even like the spectators themselves. In the case of Vixen, he did end up writing to the place of work of one of the people that testified in a case against the Meyer film and stated that their employee was a degenerate because he testified in this case. And so he was really quite aggressive in targeting the spectator in a certain way, but also in this interest of building an argument around who has the claim to privacy, who has the claim to public space, who has the claim to propriety. But I think it is an unfortunate alliance in a variety of ways, because one can understand it historically, and we obviously see it emerging in the 80s as well around the Mies Commission and also the anti-porn feminist positions. But I think it is an interesting time to return to those questions too, to think about those genealogies of thought and where those convergences are. One of the unfortunate things that that alliance does is really disavow labor and thinking through labor in a more nuanced way and thinking about the autonomy and choice in respects to conditions of labor, right? And there's interesting. And I was quite interested in performance and labor in these films and in sex films in general, how the sex act in some ways catalyzes questions of labor and performance, because in the case of sexploitation films, there's always this argument about deception, right? That they're deceptive in some way. There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, I don't think that Marx has been fully enveloped in our understanding of pornographic texts yet at all. There's still a lot to be done. You kind of also write about this interesting thing that I had never heard of as a way for the industry to regulate itself through this idea of the Adult Film Association. Can you tell us a little bit about how they came to fruition and what were some of their goals in being created?
Yeah, it's an interesting moment in the late 60s, because exploitation films by the late 60s had fairly saturated the market. This coincided with a period when Hollywood was at its nadir, as Robert Sklar and other historians write. There's this point of the Hollywood industry's bottoming out in terms of its economic crisis and the number of films was producing. So there's this real opening for imports, but also in particular sexploitation films to really fill theaters. And so this was like the peak of their saturation of the market. But I think one of the ways Adult Film Producers Association, called the AFAA, was developed out of an interest in banding together amongst the various producers of sex films on the West and the East Coast and elsewhere. So the major producers, people like Pete Kaufman, David Friedman, got together and created this organization, but also as a way to deal with obscenity cases and the ways in which they felt they were being persecuted by the local authorities and the police, to have a place to talk through strategies for ameliorating policing of theaters. I mean, a number of producers had bought theater chains. And so there's this way of brainstorming. And in some ways, it paralleled the development of the MPAA in Hollywood history. And so one of the things that they introduced in discussions at the time, I think it was proposed by Bob Cressy, was ironically a production code which would delineate strategies of representation of things that they would and wouldn't show in films. This proposal didn't pass, but I think it was a really interesting moment where there's a kind of retrenchment of the producers of these films that really are holding on to discourses of censorship and really need certain guidelines of censorship to continue to exist. And this is also a time when we see the development of 16mm features. There's hardcore shorts being shown in theaters and the development of a kind of sex industry. There's a diversification of different kinds of sex acts that you can see on film, even if they're peeps, right? Peep shows are also developing at this time. And so that there's this way that the industry, they're trying to consolidate themselves as an industry, but also to deal with and distinguish themselves as a kind of quality player in the market as compared to these upstarts. And this is something that Eric Schaefer talks about in his book about 16mm as a gauge of production, that is in this intermediate period between sexploitation being established and the hardcore feature emerging in the early 70s. And so it's right in this moment that that organization is born as a way of protecting its kind of economic and public interests.
And you published this amazing list of suggestions for possible self-imposed industry code, which is astounding. Some of the suggestions are that there will be no scenes depicting kissing below the waist or above the knee of any individual, that generally we would agree to strive to avoid the blatant graphic reproductions of sexual acts and instead rely on suggestion rather than reality. Well, if that's going to be the case, why even bother seeing a sexploitation film? And that we would not hold up to ridicule the marriage laws, the institution of marriage, parental respect, and the police, city, state, or federal government. It's really an amazing list here.
It's a kind of like retrenchment. It's really clear that makers of exploitation films were middle-aged men, middle class, and white. So that there is a kind of conservatism to the films, even though there are places where that is challenged, obviously. But there is this way that there's a sense of in which there's an obeisance to a kind of more conservative public that is articulated in things like, we're not going to ridicule marriage laws. Obviously, their films had been ridiculing marriage laws for years, you know.
Yeah, just look at The Awful Truth.
This is 69, right. And so that there is this interesting way that the code itself was going against, contravening what they were already doing in films for quite some time. But it seemed like this really interesting moment of like, oh, we need to self-correct and establish our own production code as a way of really protecting ourselves from intervention. So it really parallels in an interesting way, kind of a moment when the production code is developed in the 30s, ironically enough. And it obviously, knowing what we know of kind of development of hardcore, this is something that seems even more ironic or poignantly ironic. Knowing what's coming in a few years, right? It's like knowing that
there was nothing that was going to be able to stop the flood tide from coming.
Mm-hmm, right, exactly.
And you bring up a really interesting point that I had never even thought of. You talk a bit about the Screen Actors Guild role once these films started emerging, and then Hollywood films started including nudity as well as a way to compete with sexploitation films. What role did they take in kind of regulating how nudity would be dealt with by the union?
Well, it was interesting because sexploitation films were not union film. They were not made with non-union staff. And so there was also a way of like making them cheap. Meyer and Metzger could operate on slightly higher budgets, but generally the average budget of a sexploitation film was $10,000 to $40,000. So the mode of production of these films was very low. So they were kind of made on the margins of the industry, in that the Hollywood industry, which relied on the, you know, union labor, felt there was another kind of threat there too, and that manifested in the sense of a scuffle that we see happening in the early 60s, where Hollywood felt the need to distinguish itself from sexploitation films. And even though some Hollywood films were featuring some nudity, and actresses were, you know, in some cases complaining, in some cases advocating for it as a mode of a valid artistic expression, Carol Baker being one, but the Screen Actors Guild in a way played this role in that they were advocating for actresses and working in Hollywood, but the actresses who were working in sexploitation films were not part of that union. So there's a marking of a kind of class distinction and a hierarchy in relationship to who does or doesn't act in the nude, even though someone like Carol Baker or Jane Mansfield, they were stars who were beginning to agree to do nude scenes in Hollywood films. And so there is this really interesting moment around questions of labor that would be kind of really interesting to explore further. I mean, it's something that got condensed in the book around nudity, and the nudity kind of catalyzed this kind of problem of union or non-union labor. And in many ways, sexploitation films were maligned because they didn't have the star power of Hollywood. I mean, one of the many ways in which they were maligned or kind of always seen as marginal. And so that actors who worked in sexploitation often were women who worked in modeling, were trying to get a foot in the industry, may have posed in the nude, and so that they would work in that circuit and generally make about 50 to 100 a day, which isn't atrocious, but also obviously pales in comparison to a kind of contract star in Hollywood. And so there are really interesting class dynamics there and how they play out for the films, you know, how one perceives the films themselves.
It would be interesting to imagine the Screen Actors Guild attempting to unionize these workers, but then you can't have a union, it seems, without there being non-union films for people to be able to break into the industry. So there's this tension between unionized labor rights and the need for there to be, you know, independent productions in order to fuel a new energy into Hollywood, which is a difficult balance a lot of the time.
The question of union labor in this period in relationship to the status of the indie is super interesting also to explore. I mean, it's always, it wasn't just about the actor labor, but also all the other labor too, because they weren't paying union rates for the cinematographer or the director. So,
yeah. And this brings up one of the best points you make in the book when you write that the narrative logic of sex in the films is never truly free, but is a subject and object of a moral economy of act and moral consequence in which sex is perennially grounded in an unequal exchange between power and pleasure, unquote. It's as if you're trying to crack the code of sexploitation throughout the book. And of course, a big part of cracking the code has to do with capitalism. You work with John DeMillo and Estelle Friedman, who make the point that capitalist impulse seizes upon sexual desire as an unmet need that that the marketplace could fill. It's interesting how you're working, I guess, a lot like Deleuze and Guattari. You're working with Freud and Marx to kind of situate the role that sexploitation plays in this moment. Is it fair to say that you're kind of working through sexploitation as a mode of the unconscious, a mode of Freudian understanding of libido, of a political materialist economy of Marx? Is that fair to say, or is that just one angle that you could approach it at?
I suppose one could say that. That wasn't a kind of an overt methodology that I used, but I was interested in thinking about the marketplace as a problem and a facilitating domain for the films, and the ways that the films were these mercantile objects and they were commodities and they traded on the commodity of sex as something that could be bought and something that could be consumed and one could gain pleasure from it. I'm interested in that kind of developing market for sex and images of sex in a larger economy, a larger ecology of practices, and the development of what we might understand as a sex industry. But the book itself doesn't necessarily elaborate those methods, either Freudian or Marxist methods, but I think I'm asking questions that are aligned with those theoretical frameworks. But certainly, I guess for me, the fundamental contradiction of sexploitation is the ways in which they use the mantle of the aesthetic and of art to protect itself legally in relationship to obscenity law, but also the ways that they're kind of bottom feeders in the sea of a market economy, and they're really taking and drawing from anything available to make money, and they're really about fast return with minimal investment, quickest and largest possible return. And so in some ways that cynicism pervades the films, but it also pervades the sexual politics of the films, which are often about women who are themselves circulating commodities in an economy that ultimately exploits them. And so, I mean, I try to take up those questions with some amount of lightness and humor as well, and not just a grinding understanding of the ways in which patriarchy and capitalism work together, because I think the films are quite peculiar objects, and they're weirdly reflexive objects because they're very aware of themselves. And so that contradiction between a promise of something aesthetic and then the degradations of the market, but also the contradictions of some kind of liberatory potential and a kind of prohibitive moral economy, which the films often end with these very depressing endings, they kind of begin to shift by the late 60s. And there's quite a variance across the films. The films are very strange, and a lot of interesting characters and talented people worked in this field. There were hundreds and hundreds, some people have said up to 1,000 films that were made in the decade. And so that to account for all those films, one has to look at them closely and really embrace those contradictions within them.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people think that this era, since it's short, there aren't that many films, or they're not as dynamic. But I think the great part of your book is that you show the great range of dynamism within the films. As the era starts to wind down, we get back to this question of boredom. And it's interesting how there's a critical discourse around boredom as a way to situate these films against other films, which is kind of interesting. Especially as the exploitation films start to make way for the early nudist films, you go on to explain how writers and critics started to situate the in-theater experience as boring. You have an amazing quote from writer David Moeller describing his experience as such. He writes, "Once inside, you begin to feel a growing sense of disenchantment. You feel taken because the lobby advertisement and the 150 that had led you to expect something special. The all-male audience of the cinema I went to was not made up of sexual deviants and perverts in the final throes of sexual crescendo, and one only had to be seated in front of the screen for a few minutes to see why. There is something rather sexless about a nudist film. Once one has gotten over the initial shock of seeing a little more of the female torso than usual, after all, once there's nothing more to hint at or infer or to expose gradually, a great deal of excitement is taken out of the nude female bosom. The sheer fact of a lady's nudity inhibits rather than enhances the salacious elements of the film." So I guess he's documenting when the bras and the panties finally come off, it's not as exciting as the sexploitation films. Can you talk a little bit about why there's this political and social motivation behind critics describing these films as boring, and how does that enliven the history that you're trying to bring to light, the sexploitation films, which still leave something hidden?
Well, I think that in many ways, sexploitation films really required a kind of sensorial environment and an environment of prohibition for them to have a charge and to have a currency. One of the implications of that at the level of spectatorship is also both an uneasiness, but also a taking of account of what it means to be in the theater watching these things and to be tracing the emergence or the possibility of one's arousal, one's pleasure, but also marking it in a way as something that is aesthetic and through a language of discernment. This comes from the fourth chapter, which is in a way my favorite chapter because it's a lot about these historical accounts of watching the films and discourses around the spectator that develop in the critical reception of the mode of production. And so in this instance, what's really interesting is that he's talking about this disenchantment or kind of being cheated in a way. And that discourse of deception that I mentioned earlier is obviously in play. It's like, do they really show what they promised to show? On the one hand, a kind of consumer logic of like, am I getting what I paid for? But there are a lot of implications of that. There are a lot of really complexities within that about the deceptive nature of the aesthetic experience of the sex film and the extent to which it can ever possibly deliver, and like the nature of the ways in which one is packaged one's own desire in the promotional address and the tease of these films. And so the discourse of boredom emerges in a way as it's kind of a form of managing certain anxieties and tensions, but it's also a way of deflecting and deferring and filtering through of aesthetic discernment. It builds an idea of connoisseurship out of what would otherwise be a malign or kind of despicable, disreputable activity of going into a sex film house. And so what I found really fascinating were like the varieties, the different shades and textures of boredom that were being articulated by various critics and interlopers who were dipping their toe into watching these films. And often there's this kind of quality of like a kind of gonzo journalism or participant observation that these writers engage in. They're like, I'm not a regular viewer of these films, but I'm going to watch them. And so this is the case for David Mahler, right? Or people that are film critics or cinephiles of one kind or another that wouldn't deign to be seen in it, but then write a piece about it. And so I felt like at the time, you get a sense of that milieu of film going through these accounts too. And boredom, obviously, you know, it does a lot of different things. It buffers an implication of arousal, of a kind of more hot-blooded or conventional way of relating to the image, because it's not as interesting to say that that was a turn-on. And so there are a lot of different things that boredom does, but boredom is also an alliance with a kind of more cinephile positionality that creates a discourse of connoisseurship. And that to me is interesting, the way that the art film discourse intersects with, and the cinephile discourse in film culture in the 60s intersects with, this kind of discourse about spectatorship in sex films. And so for me, that was one of the most fascinating things about it. This giving an account of oneself, this kind of like confession of all the stirrings of desire, I thought was super interesting. And there are a lot of different accounts in that chapter.
Well, it's interesting that all of these articles that you're citing in the book are written before Linda Williams writes about body genres, in the sense that, you know, all of these popular genres evoke, you know, feelings of the body that separate you from critical detachment. Like, in order to be a critic or a sophisticated or an intellectual, you need to be detached from the text. And if you are aroused or excited or scared of the text, then you've lost your critical distance. So it's interesting how the boredom is a way for them to establish this critical distance.
And that's an interesting point. There is a way that one could read a variety of films. These are the kinds of films that are implicitly being challenged or contested in the development of the kind of feminist movement, but also in the kind of ways in which feminist film theory takes up a notion of the apparatus and the ways in which desire works in cinema. In the same way that I think that the Doris Wishman film was this unwitting exercise in screen theory, one could also think about the ways that sexploitation films in some ways stage certain problems of the filmic apparatus and desire that then begin to be investigated in psychosemiotics and feminist film theory. It's just that these domains never really meet. It's almost like an imagined convergence, but they're certainly there and circulating in the culture. There's an awareness of them, if not an engagement with them. And I think that's interesting to think about too.
And I think one of the advantages of studying such a short time period like you do is the sense of immediate nostalgia once it's gone. You have this amazing quote from Andrew Sarris in The Waning Days of Sexploitation, when he writes that, even if hardcore pornography were driven underground once more, it is doubtful that movies would ever return to their original state of coy lyricism, to their sexless satyrs and hard-boiled virgins, in short, to their infinite hypocrisy. The road back from porn to corn is effectively blocked by a society bumping and grinding to the tune of manipulative advertising and clinical journalism, sin in the suburbs. These were the days when the dirty movie seemed on the verge of becoming a stimulating subgenre. So Andrew Sarris, who in fairness, you know, did acknowledge his physicality, and he said that he knows he's aroused in a theater when he gets an erection, he kind of bemoans the coming of porn and is immediately nostalgic for this era of sexploitation that is already fading before his eyes.
I think that Sarris is, I mean, that quote is so fascinating. And that that also surprised me because I thought, well, you know, here is somebody that's already marking the end of something. I mean, he's writing in like 1972 or so, 1971, and he's describing a period between 1962 and 1968, and that's when that coy lyricism of this exploitation film, which is embodied for him in the great auteurist possibility of Joe Sarno's films, is at its height. And what surprised me was that in some ways here is someone marking the end and already talking about a waning, embodying a kind of belatedness, articulating the quality of obsolescence that pervades sexploitation. And I thought that, okay, that obsolescence is something that we retroactively produce in viewing these films from a distance, right? We're watching these films in the 90s, the 2000s, and we're looking back at this moment with some kind of nostalgia. But I realized that that discourse of obsolescence was actually there and embedded in the films of the period in a way that I was really struck by, but also in the kind of discourse of the period, as in the case of Saris, who's already... There's something about the newness of sex and the newness of new forms of new ways of representing sex and showing sex on screen in this period, right? To what seemed like a radical shift from this exploitation film to like hardcore explicit sex on screen that in some ways allows this historicizing, this looking backwards. And you see it in other films. You see it in things like History of the Blue Movie made by Dorenzi. Right, there's this interest in making sex historical in a way and marking time in relationship to the sexual image or in relationship to what the sexual image does or doesn't show.
And Joe Damiano, too, with his documentary. Changes.
Oh yeah, that's right, with Changes. That's right. There's so many films that do it. So for me, I think that question of like newness and pastness in relationship to sex, or like that we use sex as this marker of the currency of the present and as this marker of the present. And then there's this hyper awareness around when something is dated or becomes outdated. And I think that was something that I wanted to not overstate the case, or in some ways I kind of held off. I felt like I was overreading. But then I find a quote like this from Saris, who's already talking about a period that's in the past, and it's only like a few years prior, right? Or he's like lamenting the end of something. And I think that there's something that's heightened or catalyzed by the sex film and this environment in this period. And that I found quite fascinating. It's also something that David Church, who you've had on the show as well, talks about in a different register in his book, Disposable Passions, to the kind of relationship of pastness to the sexed image.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess there's a need to insert Deleuze Cinema number 2, the time image, which he kind of does a little bit, but it certainly could be more inserted in, I guess, in other aspects of porn studies. And I guess we could wrap up just by talking about your new appointment. Congratulations, you've been elected the co-chair of the Adult Film History Group, which is a subset interest group within the Society of Film and Media Studies. It's in its third year, going on its fourth year, I think.
I think it's in its fourth year, yeah.
Fourth year, yeah. So kind of describe maybe what an academic study group is and what kind of projects has the study group done in the past and what kind of things you imagine moving forward in your new position.
So I'm co-chair with Lynn Comella, who you've also had on the show. The Adult Film History Group is a special interest group. There are many, many special interest groups in the Society of Cinema and Media Studies around different research areas and constituencies. So, for example, there's a non-theatrical group, there's a group on Hollywood cinema, there's a group, so there are various, and they're called special interest groups, and they aggregate the people working in that field and encourage new work, and it's a kind of community network and support network. It was established by Eric Schaefer and Peter Alalunas and founded in 2014, and Peter has just fulfilled his tenure as the co-chair, and Lynn stepped in and was elected as the new co-chair. And so that the group is, in many ways, it's a community space, but also a place in which we kind of support and highlight the work that is being done in this field of adult film and media history. Among the things that have happened and are happening, one of the initiatives that Peter Alalunas, he has developed with Dan Erdman, is the Adult Film History Project, which is an ongoing effort to archive adult film materials. And I think he's partnered with archive.org so that people can upload their ephemera, magazines, what have you, onto archive.org, and they're kind of hosting the site. But you can look up the Adult Film History Project and see the website about it. And so that's one of the developing projects that the group has spawned. We also have a meeting at the SCMS conference every year. Last year, we had a seminar about methods that was quite successful, I thought. And this year, we're working on a number of initiatives. Among them is we're working on an event, hopefully with Something Weird Video, because the conference is in Seattle. So we'll be talking about the history of Something Weird Video with Lisa Petrucci. The event is being organized by David Church, so fingers crossed that proceeds with funding and everything else. And we're also working on a newsletter so that our members can tell us what they're working on and, you know, accolades and publications that they've received or that they've things that they've published, work that they're doing. We're also in the very beginning stages of having conversations about ways of aggregating our knowledge and resources around various archives that hold adult film and media materials as a way of crowdsourcing information. And I mean, in some cases, those archives have specific challenges that come with doing this kind of research because there isn't really a central archive and the condition of materials is often quite dire in various archives. And so we're kind of wanting to support our members' research by investigating ways of gathering together information about various archives around the world that have those materials into kind of one single place. And that's kind of a long-term project. In addition, you know, we also circulate information from time to time about what our members are doing and kind of mentor students. So there's a mentor program that people are working in the field and are members of a CMS. They can sign up to have a mentor and someone will get assigned to them so that they can talk about professional challenges and things like that. So it's a very supportive community and one that we're very aware of the specific challenges of working in this area and want to be able to share kind of what we know and to aggregate and develop different initiatives. Obviously, this political climate comes with a variety of other challenges to higher education more generally. And so I think there's a sense in which there's even more of a weight in doing this kind of research. And there's a feeling of this research being under threat in certain ways, but also very necessary as well.
Absolutely. I think it's a testament to the excitement around the group and to the study that you can get almost 20 people at 9 a.m. in the morning in Toronto to come to a seminar. So it was really successful and it turned out really good. A lot of exciting work going on. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, but thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Let me tell you, this was a period of film history that I really knew very little about. And picking up this very readable, very exciting, and very interesting book really just filled in a lot of gaps for me. So please, if you're interested in this kind of stuff, or even if you think you may not be interested in this kind of stuff, it is a wonderful read. So really, congratulations on it. It's really a wonderful accomplishment. Once again to Elena for joining us from across the pond. It's really greatly appreciated. Be sure to check out the show notes where you can find out more about her book and the history of sexploitation. This is a link to hear an interview that Elena did for the journal Feminist Media Histories. She recently edited a special issue of the journal titled Sex and the Materiality of Adult Media. You're not going to want to miss out on that. There's also a short video history of Something Weird Video and a link where you can buy sexploitation movies from their catalog. After you're done checking out the notes, please be sure to follow us on social media. You can follow us on facebook.com/academicsex and on Twitter @pornocultures. Thanks so much for listening and I look forward to getting sexy with you next time.